Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. And greetings, everybody. Welcome to Behind the Curtain, our weekly podcast, and we're going to start with a look at politics this week. Every week seems appropriate to take a look at what's going on, but kind of a rich body of topics to talk about certainly this week. Joining me today is Michael Golden, the author of a great book called Unlock Congress. It's met with great acclaim from people, members of Congress. That tells you something. He's also the president of Golden Mean Strategies, somebody you want to touch base with if you're living and want to live in the political world. And he returns to the podcast. Michael, good to talk to you again.
I love being behind the curtain, Paul. Thank
you. Isn't that a great name?
I agree it is. Yeah.
It was better than under the curtain. I don't know. You know, you come up with names. But
it's
hey, look,
a pleasure.
We always talk about national topics, and we're going to do that today. But we are talking at a time when the violence level in Chicago has just been astounding. And so I had to kind of start in that realm. I mean, I'm not bringing you on as a violence expert. That's not your world. Your world is politics. And so it's been fascinating to watch the reaction. Over 70 people shot in this city over a weekend. You know, it continues. And what we get is an emotional mayor, an angry mayor, an angry police superintendent, and a whole bunch of people who want the mayor's job, who point fingers at him and then talk about how to fix this. As a guy who understands political strategy at every level and from every direction, let me just start by asking you for your general take on how this is being handled. And the violence is tragedy, the violence is horrendous, but how's it being handled politically?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting, both the mayor's response and the superintendent's response, the police superintendent, Eddie Johnson, and you could tell that they were coordinated. And I think that part of it is very genuine and visceral, that there's only so much you can do to attack this problem with law enforcement. And I think a ton of people in this city know that. They're scared to say it. They're scared to talk about personal responsibility. And I think even Superintendent Johnson, to quote a phrase that I believe Hillary Clinton made famous, said, "I'm okay with it takes a village." And I'm also glad that you talked about this, because there are efforts going on in Chicago, Chicago CRED, and also a program that's been kind of under the radar for a year called Ready Chicago, that's run by Heartland Alliance.
Yeah,
and they're taking it's amazing. Evelyn Diaz, who's the head of Heartland, has taken a holistic approach to this, where they're targeting the potential victims and perpetrators of Chicago violence and taking them out, getting them into cognitive behavioral therapy, but also getting them into jobs right away and building esteem and independence from the work. They're both, I think, I know that Evelyn's working with the U of C Chicago Crime Lab and predictive analytics to figure that stuff out, and they're making real progress. The problem is that when these things happen, these tragic, disgusting, I mean, basically they're mass shootings. It's a semantic argument about what to call them, but you're talking about a mass shooting over the weekend that happens frequently, not to the degree we saw on Sunday, but you see that in the news and you don't see as much context about all the good that's being done. And I thought that both Mayor Emanuel and Superintendent Johnson were clearly showing frustration with that. There's only so many times you can say we're going to add X officers, we're going to move these guys around to different districts. At the end of the day, it's a much deeper issue than just putting cops on the beat.
You know, I don't disagree with anything you said, but when you talk about mass shooting, one of the things that suggests is that there's some sort of coordination to this, that there's, you know, these things are, I mean, we don't know, actually, but I'm going to guess that so much of this, other than calling a lot of it probably gang-related, don't even know that for sure, but these are just separate incidents going on all over the city. These are people just getting pissed off in various places all over the city and taking it out with their guns. So is that different from a mass shooting when you think of one guy who's taken down a whole group of people, like Las Vegas?
Yeah, but again, that's exactly it. It's a semantic difference. In fact, you could make the argument that, you know, look, you don't want to compare numbers of homicides, numbers of murders and deaths in different incidents, but people in Chicago, guys like you and me, and the people who live here, this is something we see that's brutally awful to read about and hear about, but it's not a surprise. The mass shootings that happen in these one-time events, there's usually somebody who's pretty screwed up. This is a different type of thing, and it goes to culture as well. The same 10 or 12 neighborhoods in Chicago have been having the same issues for decades. And you probably remember the Chicago Project for Violence Prevention that was, they were called ceasefire zones back then.
Sure.
There's all kinds of really hard work and great effort going on in those communities. But there's no magic, pardon the expression, I was going to say magic bullet, silver bullet answer. There's no simple solution to this. And I think that that's what you were hearing the mayor and the superintendent say. I'm not sure how that plays politically, but I'm not sure how much the mayor cares anymore. I'm not sure how much else he can say at a press conference to soothe or make Chicagoans feel better, because he knows, and so does the superintendent, you can't just fix it with cops. I hope more people take a look at Ready Chicago by Heartland and what Arne Duncan is doing with Chicago Cred, because they are really going after the root causes of this. And it takes time. Even if it's making progress, it takes years.
The mayor talks a lot about the too many guns on the street and all those related things to the violence and the guns and the trafficking and whatever. And, you know, I had Alderman Rod Sawyer of the 6th Ward on my show the other night. And you know, he talked, and many of the mayoral candidates are talking about the social programs that are needed, the education, mm-hmm. the jobs, all of that. It's hard to disagree with any of it, any of the mayor's comments, the candidate's comment. It's all true. But it sounds like it's a multi-year investment that has been going on for years anyway. The problem seems to just maintain its level of seriousness. And so what do you do? Start an education program tomorrow and fix this in a week? I mean, that's the problem. It's years away before anything can even make a difference.
Well, and believe me, I'm not. I don't work for Heartland Alliance, so I'm not a shilling to give them any publicity. But I'm going to bring them up again, because what they've done is they've raised $16 million from corporations, and they've kept it very quiet for most of the last year to go into the neighborhoods and start doing this work. And they've gotten 180 people into their programs. So that may not sound like a lot of people when you're using predictive analytics to find folks that are at risk of either being the victim of violence or the perpetrator of violence. That's a real record, and getting them out into programs, not just of therapy, but working. So J.P. Morgan alone gave that program $2 million. And, you know, and a lot of other corporations have done the same thing, not just with Ready Chicago, but with Arne's project. And it's hard to see that progress, and it doesn't get reported on as much as some of this sensational violence. I'm not saying they shouldn't cover that violence, but it does take time, Paul. And by the way, if you go to New York and Los Angeles, which have both really improved on cutting down on violence and on the gang culture over the last 20 years, it took them years too. Chicago may be more complicated in a way, and that's for crime lab scientists to tell you, not me. Like you said, I'm not an expert on this, but it takes time, and you have to hit a bunch. You have to hit a bunch of angles at the same time, because they all connect up. I have some experience with this with 1 Million Degrees, the scholarship program that we run for low-income community college students. Now, they're not. None of them have criminal records. They have other challenges in terms of trying to achieve their degree, but they come from these neighborhoods, and they are not foreign to this risk and living their lives. I mean, it's just, you're talking about communities that have had to have safe passages funded by the federal government to get kids to school. So, and by the way, with our students who are looking for an opportunity to work hard and get their degree, and they need some help, that's a population that needs help, and that's why we started the scholarship program. When you talk about the people that are committing these crimes or have repeat felony records, it's just much more difficult.
I hear you. Now, I don't actually know if you have a horse in this mayoral race, so you'll have to, you can, yeah. Well, do you? Because if you do, I won't ask you this next question.
I do not have a horse that's running. Let's put it that way.
Okay. So the question I want to ask you is, because obviously if you're working for somebody, it's not a fair question. But so from the outside, looking at all of this, as you understand the dynamics, we've got all the candidates trying to point the fingers at Rahm. I asked Alderman Sawyer, you know, how much of this do you put at Rahm's feet in terms of the blame? He said, not much. So my question to you is, does this problem get can Rahm fix it? Do we need a new mayor? Or is that kind of an irrelevant question because the problem is bigger than any of them?
I think your last point is correct. It's bigger than any of them. Now, you saw in the news how Gary McCarthy and Paul Vallis, at least I saw the two of them, were hitting Rahm on this, and they're going to hit him on everything. They're going to hit him on the police misconduct and trials. They're going to hit him on the money. They're going to hit him on all the problems that the city has. But I have to tell you, in terms of this multi-candidate race and the likelihood of a runoff, it's breaking through with some kind of positive, strengthening message for the city that's going to be difficult. They're all going to try to use Rahm as a punching bag, but they're all punching at the same person. So what sets them apart is someone who's going to be a visionary, and more than a visionary, a tough leader for the city. I don't know how you feel about this, but for the last, almost 30 years, there have been two mayors. And they were both, whatever you think about Daley and Emanuel, I don't think many people would say they weren't decisive. That they, and especially I give Mayor Emanuel credit for taking on tough problems and making difficult decisions. It's for others to decide when they vote whether they were the right decisions. No. But to your final point, I don't think one mayor, especially in 6 months, right, till the runoff, they're not going to be able to fix this problem. The question is, are any of the programs that they're involved in strengthening the community? And it's very hard to get that message through when something like this happens over the weekend, right? Because it pulls everybody's attention from the long game, which is what you and I are talking about in terms of strengthening the city when it comes to violence reduction. So, I mean, Rahm is still, it doesn't matter what his poll numbers are. He's the incumbent. He has a ton of money. He's got a ton of people behind him. And he has made some decisions that a lot of people in the city agree on. I think that one of these people, Vallis or Lightfoot or McCarthy, they're going to have to bust out of the pack with a stronger positive message. That's just hard to do, as you know, even if you have the financial resources.
Right. And you're not going to even out. I mean, listen, Gary McCarthy can say what he wants. He was superintendent of police, right?
Right.
He's the guy, he was around with Laquan McDonald and all of that. I'm not putting that at his feet, but I'm just saying he was around dealing with all that kind of stuff. Lori Lightfoot, part of the police accountability process and all of that. So, I mean, there are a couple of these candidates who have stronger holds in that field, and I'm just curious, does it hurt or help them?
Yeah, I don't think this stuff of hammering on the mayor, especially like you said with those two, helps much right now. But I have to tell you, and I know a strategist in both of their camps, I don't think that matters as much right now. I think that they're trying to take some shots, trying to get news coverage and be looked at as the front-running candidates in the first, the primary election. And then, when we get further into when people are actually paying attention. I mean, we've got the midterms in 3 months. The mayor's race early next year, I think that's when these guys are going to try to bust through with the strategic message that's bigger for the city. Maybe in ads before that, over the holidays, to try to get ahead of it. But right now, I think they're just taking shots where they can, trying to put chinks in the armor.
All right, let's turn national. Spent a lot of time on that, but it's an important topic. But I do have a couple things I just want to run by you. And one, it's the media bashing. And I ask you about, because listen, it impacts me. It impacts obviously the world that I live in. And you live in worlds so closely related to media and working it yourself. You've got Sarah Sanders, the press secretary, who when asked by Jim Acosta of CNN, Sarah, would you please just say the media is not the enemy of the people? She would not say that. And, of course, you have the president who basically says, I'm not saying all the media is the enemy of the people, whatever that means. But what it means is Fox is not, Sinclair is not, but CNN and MSNBC and everybody, they are. You talk to people around the country, the Trump supporters, and the rage is building. It was a fun talking point maybe when all of this started, but it's not a game anymore. And you are seeing a lot of people making comments that say one day there could be something happens and there could be the blood of journalists spilled on the ground, and that will be on the president's hands. What's your take on all of that?
Yeah, Paul, boy, especially because I used to be a reporter and still do commentary, and you and I talk about this stuff. We could talk about this for an hour and a half because there's so many dimensions to it. But if you distill it down, what the president, first of all, the president keeps changing the message. He didn't first say the quote fake news is the enemy of the people. He said the press is. So he changes these right. things all the time and whittles around the edges. But with regard to your question about Sarah Sanders, look, she and Sean Spicer, they chose to take impossible jobs. You can't do that job well if you work for this president. Because it's hard enough to do that job when you're on this balancing beam of protecting the president and speaking on behalf of the White House and also telling the truth or moving your way around it however you answer reporters' questions. That's a constant game that's gone on forever in politics, right? Where the journalists try to get the truth. Politicians try to say as much of the truth as they can without ruining what they're trying to fight for, their political chances of getting reelected. That's the game. The problem is with this president, if you have thousands of lies and you have things that are so blatantly offensive to tens of millions of people, maybe not, you know, a third of the country or, you know, that 35% that staunchly supports him.
Right.
She's got, you know, she has a choice. What is she, if she says something, first of all, the right thing to do is, of course, for her to stand up and say, no, the press is not the enemy of the people. The press is protected by the First Amendment. The press is what has investigated and discovered all kinds of wrongdoing going back 230 years, but for which the public wouldn't know. So the press keeps us accountable. That's what her answer should have been. Or just one sentence of no.
Well, and you know, yeah, but here's
the thing is,
okay, so
if she says that, she's basically saying that she disagrees with the president and she's the voice piece of the president. That's how she sees it.
Well,
so the right thing to do is to say, no, of course not. But these people are so allied and allegiant to President Trump that I don't think that they can see through the gray area.
I think that's right. And I think it's, you know, you don't necessarily get truth when she speaks. You just get the president's voice. And
you
see a lot of former press secretaries who are, you know, a bit put back by the fact that press secretaries, you know, have a broader role and a broader obligation to the press as well. I mean, to me, look, even the president, when Ivanka Trump was asked at a conference, you know, is the media the enemy of the press? She said no. And the president tweeted going, well, the media is not the enemy of the press. The fake news is. And that's what you were
right.
saying. She could have just said, look, there are fake stories. There are false stories. Things that turn out not to be true, or there are reports that lead people to have me thrown out of a Red Rooster restaurant. I can't even eat in public. So I have some issues with it. There are ways of addressing it, but then doing what you said as well, which is to say, but of course, at its fundamental core, the press is critical to the process of democracy.
Yeah, and you can tell when she talks about this, I don't know how you could not have emotion involved if you're doing that job for that president and people are accosting you and the media are rough in that situation. But it's not the media's fault. It's the president's fault for eliciting these questions that we have. He's the one who starts it all the time. And then Sarah Sanders has got to clean it up. Like I said, it's an impossible job. And a lot of people say that, look, if you accept that job, you're basically turning in your integrity. Of course, it's not that simple. There's bargains that go on, and people rationalize all kinds of things in politics, especially in the scope of trying to get policies passed that they've wanted to pass for years. It's the same with members of Congress, and those guys have to get reelected. That's the other thing. People are always asking me, how can the Republicans in the House, how can they not stand up and XYZ and do this to the president? And I explain to them, even though I feel the same way they do, our Constitution was designed for members of Congress to have as their first priority getting reelected. A lot of people don't know that. They debated term limits and they dispensed with them. So these guys, you know, they're all thinking, if I stand up to Trump and lose my primary, I don't have any followers and I can't make any decisions anymore on behalf of the people.
And one tweet from Trump and I'm out of this thing.
Right. That's the fascinating thing about this, that as much as someone like me is disgusted by a man like Donald Trump, the fact is that he has worked this situation to a place where there is enough of that base that is loyal enough to him to affect all these elections. Mark Sanford in South Carolina, a former governor, a guy who stood up to Trump time and time again, he went down in flames. That right. There's your proof right there.
Well, and you've got, and there's other races that the president speaks out in which he's even, you know, look, Joe Arpaio almost won in the last election. And, you know, it's almost as though, you know, people's backgrounds, what they're accused of, and none of that matters. We are living in an age where none of it matters. The president speaks. And, you know, there was a poll recently that said among Trump supporters, they believe what their family members tell them at about a level of 60%. And they believe what the president tells them at a level over 80%, which is sort of an amazing, I don't care who the president is, but to say, oh, I'm more likely to be the president than my spouse. I'm more likely to believe the president than my family member. Wow. I don't care who the president is. What planet are you living on?
It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. You could understand that statistic a little more with a more traditional president, because ostensibly the president is speaking on behalf of the country. So you would think that most of the time, if, you know, not 100%, they are politicians, but most of the time they are giving factual, truthful knowledge, and, you know, maybe they'll know more than your family members do. But with the president, where one of the nation's papers of record, the Washington Post, has recorded thousands of proven lies, what your statistic you just mentioned is truly a shocking thing. If you just sit there and try to absorb it.
Yeah, I think the Washington Post is tracking that. It was over, the last number I saw was over 4,300 or something, and I believe it was just in this year. And that the rate of them, it's not just lies, it's lies or misstatements or exaggerations or whatever. I think it's probably a broad definition of what constitutes the untruth, but clearly in the thousands. And they're saying clearly at rates much higher on a daily basis than they were in the past. And because they're working, and it's working, he's got folks behind him and stuff. And as I said, I'm not taking a position on for Trump, anti-Trump. I would say this, no matter who the president was and who, you know, is that at people have to just, you know, wake up and do their own homework and trust their own instincts and look at the world around them. And, you know, as you and I do, I watch all news. I watch Fox and I watch MSNBC and CNN.
Right.
And I check it all out. And when you talk to somebody who only watches one of those channels, their view of the world is warped.
You know what? Can I mention one more thing?
Sure.
Here's a perfect example of this, because you and I both believe in listening to the other side and trying to judge things as objectively as we can. So I can have a conversation about saying the president disgusts me while also understanding that other people support him. And last night there was a Trump supporter on Chicago Tonight, and they were talking about the media, whether this president's been mistreated or not, and she was debating Chris Bury of formerly of ABC News. And I didn't agree with most of what she said, but I did agree that the media in some ways can be unfair to this president. I think more so of the anchors on the national cable channels that ostensibly are still trying to say they're in the middle and playing it fair, not MSNBC or Fox News, but CNN. But when some of those anchors, Paul, when they get snarky and make facial expressions, I think they just can't help themselves because they're so offended by his violating the truth. But that's not really reporting the news straight. You have to just serve it up and let people decide for themselves. I just think that these guys are exhausted from correcting all the lies and being insulted by the president as the fourth estate.
And it continues. And it does continue. Michael Golden, author of Unlock Congress. If you haven't checked his book out, order it. Amazon.com. Right. Other places?
You got it.
How about your website, Michael? Can people check out your website?
Yes, michaelgolden.me. I've been on behind the curtain a few times. I always enjoy it, and we'll have to get you back on the Golden Mean podcast soon. I always have a great conversation with you whenever we talk politics.
Well, and that is mutual, and I thank you, my friend. Mutual Admiration Society. Thanks for your time, as always. We will talk again soon, and for now, have a good one.
There's no business like show business, and all go. Traveling around the country is so thrilling. Standing out in front on opening night, smiling while you watch the theater filling, and it's your belly up there in line.
Ah, yes.
No,
as we shift from the world of politics to the world of theater, there is no business like show business. And I always try in the podcast, when we cover entertainment, to bring a variety of things. We do Broadway shows and musicals and dramas, all sorts of things. Well, there is a really cool event, series of events, a festival, if you will, conference coming up that you need to know about going on at the Victory Gardens Theater in Chicago. Victory Gardens is also one of the theaters we often talk about. But in this case, they're the home of something called ConFest, which is the sixth annual National Asian American Theater Conference and Festival. Put it all together, it's ConFest. And it's a week of performances and play readings and workshops and breakout sessions, parties. It's just a great time, and I want you to know about it. You might want to be able to, you might want to check it out, and let's find out from one of the board members for the Consortium of Asian American Theaters and Artists what it's all about. Jamil Corey joins me. Now, Jamil has been on the podcast before. Actually, it was quite a while ago because he's the founding artistic director of Silk Road Rising. They do their own amazing work. But it's not why he's here today. He's here with me today because we want to talk about this upcoming ConFest. So, Jamil, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back, Paul.
So, this is really an incredible event. I have some basic questions to kind of set it up. And just, I'll start with the most basic. I kind of described it, but what is ConFest? It's the sixth time this is happening. It's not the sixth annual because it hasn't been every year, I don't think. But talk about what this event's all about.
So ConFest, of course, is a combination of conference and festival, and this is a national convening of Asian American theater artists, theater producers, and our allies in the broader theater community. It's an opportunity for theater artists to share fully staged productions, staged readings, works in development, and also to have a series of conversations with practitioners, with supporters in the theater field around questions of representation and greater equity.
So this is about the work of Asian Americans. And I mean, listen, there's lots of festivals, Latino festivals, African-American festivals. Talk to me about the importance of recognizing and paying attention to the work of Asian Americans.
Well, I first want to start by saying that the definition of Asian American has really expanded within the Kata umbrella. So we're really talking about a pan-Asian gathering. Historically, Asian American theater referred to theater artists of Chinese, Korean, and Japanese backgrounds, and then expanded into Southeast Asia, Filipino, Thai. And really, over the years, we've seen the inclusion of South Asian artists, you know, people from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and now West Asian, what we would typically call the Middle East. So I am very excited by this sort of evolution in the term Asian American as Kata understands it. And it's really an opportunity. All too often, Asian voices have been, either overlooked or sidelined, even erased when people are thinking about diversity, when people are thinking about inclusion, when they're thinking about expanded representation. And of course, you know, the presence of Asian communities in this country goes back a long time. So it's a deep history and a very rich history. And yet the contributions to the larger American story that Asians have made have not always been heard or recognized or integrated into the canon of American theater.
And now I know that there are stories of, as you've said, social injustice, inequity, resistance. Are all of them with the experience of Asian American? I mean, those are part of the past of so many different groups. Is there an important focus or take in the Asian American culture that maybe people don't? I mean, I'm thinking of George Takei's work, Allegiance, for example, where, you know, that can make us feel all rotten as Americans about what we did to the Japanese Americans during World War II. I mean, are there stories here we don't know and you know, cultural aspects that we may not be familiar with?
Well, I think because we're talking about such a plethora of cultures and cultural experiences, and also generations, you know, artists whose families have been in the U.S. for, you know, 3, 4, 5 generations, as well as immigrant artists and, you know, the first generation born in the U.S. So I think the stories are very complex and complicated and broad. You know, I sometimes, you know, just personally, as someone who programs for a theater company, I don't want all of our pieces to be in this kind of react and respond mode. You know, that something happened in the news, or there's some kind of, you know, or God knows our cycles of news now are so crazy, and that we're expected to immediately react and respond and explain. I mean, I want Asian American artists and storytellers to have the ability to tell whatever story we want to tell. And also to look at, you know, just how complicated our own lives are and how many identities people may juggle at any given time.
Exactly. And by the way, it's not just these performances, but there are going to be panels, different things where people can interact. I'm really excited. I know you've got Rajiv Joseph coming, Tammy Baker and her middle name. It's tough. It's Hawaiian. So I'm pretty good with Hawaiian, but I'm going to say it's Hele Opua. If I've said that wrong, you can correct me. Haile Opua. Do I have that right?
I believe that's correct.
All right. I work on my Hawaiian. But what I'm really excited about, I want to kind of mention those names, but David Henry Hwang is coming, who wrote, of course, M. Butterfly and Chinglish, which the Goodman did a couple of years ago. I love that guy, and I love that playwright, and people will get a chance to hear him speak and interact, right?
Yes. In fact, I am interviewing David for that plenary session.
Oh, wow. Take me with you.
I just ran past him the questions I developed the other day. So that's all in the works. This is an opportunity. David Henry Hwang is, of course, a Tony Award-winning Chinese-American playwright and really a leading voice in the American theater, in Asian-American theater circles, the movement, and, of course, is now the chair of the American Theater Wing. And his most recent play, Soft Power, just had its world premiere at the Amundsen Theater in Los Angeles. So, you know, I think this is a chance to, you know, for us to interface with really an iconic figure who's about 38 years as a produced playwright. His first play, FOB, was produced in 1980. And, of course, you mentioned M. Butterfly, which recently had a Broadway revival.
Yeah.
And, you know, David, we're going to talk about questions of representation, how things have changed. We're going to look at his work in China, because he has been, he was approached by the government of China some time ago to be both a creator and an artistic consultant on projects there. So many different questions we'll be looking at.
Going to be fascinating. Some of the performances going on, and I'm sure you're familiar with them, but just feel free to pick up one to talk about it. A show called Hot Asian Everything Revolt, directed by Victor Moog, and Acquittal. So many. Is there a show coming up that has you especially excited? So many different theater groups are presenting.
Yeah, well, so, you know, some of these pieces I know, and but know having read them, and some of the pieces I'll be, you know, engaging for the first time. Of course, you know, Hot Asian Everything is almost in a variety show kind of mode. And I think it promises to be very fun and a bit daring. I'm excited about Acquittal. I read the play, Pakistani playwright Shahid Nadeem. That really tells a story about women and, you know, sort of women's struggles within a contemporary Pakistani context. And it's a play that I know, and I'm very anxious to see it, you know, performed.
Yeah, me too.
Several pieces.
Yeah, and that play is being presented by Pan Asian Repertory Theater. So the bottom line is there's so much to see. I have to tell you, I was going to open up with some music tied to the show, and I've watched a variety of clips, and people can go to the website and watch a lot of these things, a lot of these clips. The thing is that when you listen to the music from this, and of course, podcasts by their definition are just auditory experiences, at least an auditory podcast, they really don't. The music doesn't do it justice because there's the performance, the visual. I watched some Hawaiian pieces and some things that are so amazing to watch the visual. I want to encourage people to go to the website where you can check some of these things out, where the music and the visual will go together, and check it out. By the way, the website, I should say, is caata.net, caata.net. Of course, that's Consortium of Asian American Theaters and Artists, caata.net. And I'm assuming, Jamil, we can get tickets. It's individual events or maybe passes for the whole festival. All those are options, right?
Absolutely. And you know, once again, every night and morning, afternoon, there's just, you know, a wealth of performance and material. And I think, you know, whoever you are, whatever your background is, you're going to find yourself in many of these stories.
Yeah, it takes place August 13th through the 18th, so it's right around the corner. And again, it's at Victory Gardens Theater, so it's easy to get to. That's right on Lincoln Avenue, the old Biograph Theater where Dillinger was shot, as I always like to remind people, and right near Fullerton. So that's a great location. Am I right? This event, it's not always been in Chicago. I mean, this through the years, it's been in New York, different places.
Yeah, this is actually the first time that the Cotta Time Fest is in Chicago, so... you know, I think it's testimony to how this movement has essentially, what started largely on the coast, and I'm going to say even the West Coast more so than the East Coast, but well, certainly a coastal movement in large part, has really become a much more national movement. And of course, you know, in the Midwest, cities like Chicago and Minneapolis really kind of taking the lead in terms of you know, producing more plays by playwrights of Asian background. So I think that it's an exciting time for everyone to be coming to Chicago, and I think that, you know, it's just another reminder of what a special, you know, vibrant theater community we have here in our lovely city.
Without question. Of course, you serve on the board of the Consortium of Asian American Theater and Artists. You're the perfect person to talk about it, but I can't let you go without just give me a really quick update. What's happening with Silk Road Rising?
Yes, we are in the midst of our new China Festival, and we actually scheduled it at this time to, you know, run concurrent with CADA, and our readings are being offered, you know, as part of the contest. So we are presenting over three consecutive weekends stage readings of plays that are from the Chinese-speaking world. Two of the playwrights are Chinese nationals, and the third is a Taiwanese national. These are plays that have been translated into English and sort of adapted for an American vernacular. And it's a window into contemporary Chinese theater and, you know, issues that Chinese theater artists and audiences are grappling with in societies that are rapidly changing. So it's a very exciting project for us. We've been working on it for some time, you know, the whole selection process, looking at many different plays. And that, we had our first weekend we just completed, and the next two weekends, Saturday and Sunday, the readings are at 4 p.m. If you go to our website, silkroadrising.org, at silkroadrising.org, you'll find all the information.
Yes, I did that. That's why I asked you the question. I knew it was coming up.
I'm
always always in tune with what you guys are doing. And also, let me remind folks that you can go to caata.net to get tickets and check out more of the Asian American Confest that is coming up. Going to be a really great event from August 13th to the 18th at Victory Gardens Theater. Jamil Khoury, board member and the king of Silk Road Rising. Thank you for being with me, my friend. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you, Paul.
All right. Good luck. Have a great festival. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.